Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Morgan. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday. And just for my own record, this is 139.
Good to know.
Yes. So we are so close to 140, which means that we're close to June, because that'll be our first episode in June, which is my birthday month.
Which means we're so close to 150.
Which means that
mark
we're
that
so
in the fucking books.
To 150.
That's insane. We haven't been able to gasp over how many episodes we've had yet
in so
a while.
Long.
So we need to.
Can you believe it? Valerie.
Valerie's
so fun. Did everybody miss that? I missed it.
I did.
I feel like it adds.
It's
a
just
spunk.
Better than like Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday.
It's what did I say before? That was kind of cute.
Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor
and I'm Morgan and this is episode 139.
Happy Thursday. Did we bring it fucking back?
Yeah, it's back.
Okay, it's bringing it. We lasted what five episodes?
15, I would say. Don't you think?
It's been a minute.
No shot 15.
I think I think
our last like big thing was 125 and then we stopped.
We stopped after 125. That's right. Where are we at? Okay.
I don't know. We had a whole agenda to get through. So first things first, join Patreon.
Oh my God. Join Patreon because I pulled one on Morgan. So good for Ep 40.
Guys, you already know my mental state that day.
She was not good. She was throwing out in her mouth the whole time.
Literally.
The entire time.
It was the end of a day. I was like, wow, we finished so early. Like I could just go home, mm-hmm. throw up in my own toilet, not in my mouth. Yeah, come over after work. So I hadn't even been home. I was like, I'm in my scrubs. So at the end of our episode, what did we cover?
Doppelgangers, bi-location, multi-location, and astral projection.
Yeah.
But it was only supposed to be doppelgangers because we were going to do a joint situation. And then I fucking ran with it.
And Taylor had done my notes for this Patreon. So she did doppelgangers. I was like, wow, thank you. Like, love you. Like, owe you my life. She was like,
don't say thank you just yet.
Don't say thank you just yet. I need a little favor. I'm like, okay. So we're even. I went and ran an errand for her.
Lies.
That was not the favor. The favor was at the end of the episode. Surprise, bitch, lay down. You're doing a meditation.
Okay, but you can't act like I didn't take care of you. I literally had clothes for
her. She did. It was really cute. She was like, I have these. We could wear those. And it was actually really comfy. And I actually slept in the pants.
Aren't they so fucking comfortable?
Yeah. Anyway, so if you guys want to see us attempt to astral project,
go to patreon.com/creepsandcrimes.
And if you have watched it already, then you know what happened at the end.
Yeah, jump scare. Jesus Christ.
Should we tell them?
No. Only the people that watch it get to see what the fuck happened.
I will never forgive him for that. Anyway, we just had a Mother's Day this past weekend. How was
mama's?
Our mama's Mother's Day?
I hope you guys had a great weekend. I get that this is coming out 2 weeks later, so you're like...
But I'm sure it was fabulous.
What the hell are they talking about? Mother's Day goes on, okay? It's
every day
is Mother's Day.
Mother's Day.
Okay. Oh my God. By the way, congratulations to all of our graduates.
Yeah.
We got a graduation card.
And our college grads. Yeah. Emma sent us a graduation card.
She did. And we're sending you something back right now, Emma. You might have it before this episode goes out.
Hope so.
Hopefully, if everything goes as planned.
If USPS wants to work together.
Let's see. Miss Karen's going to take care of us at the post office, though. She always does.
Creeps.
Oh my God, guys. So we went to go pick up. Oh, by the way, if you haven't looked already, we launched a candle collection.
Yeah, it is so fucking cute.
It is so fucking cute.
You can use our code, capital letters, CCMERCH10. So CCMERCH10.
So
for 10% off.
Yeah. And then also we got a sweet little gift from our friend Emily Theory, Home and Lifestyle. And she gave us a code.
I can't even say sweet little gift. It was
it's a massive fucking gift.
Epic.
women-owned small business in Knoxville, Tennessee. The aesthetic on the Instagram.
Stop.
Stunning.
Like, I could give you pictures of every wall in my apartment and I would want you to style it.
And that's exactly what happened. She was like, I want to send you guys something. I want to give you guys a code for your listeners. And I'm about to tell you what it is in 1 second. If I don't tell you because the card's on the other side of the room. So I'll just put it in the description of the episode and on the Instagram post. So she's like, send us a picture of both y'all's homes and we'll send you guys something that we think fits your vibe. She sent us 2 stemless champagne flutes.
No, because I want the whole set.
I want the entire, I want everything.
Because I'll go tonight and order the entire set.
No, order it from her. Or yeah. We got to order it from you, Emily. Those are the cute. I've never seen anything like that before.
No, I want to put cocktails in it. Champagne, of course. But also coffee.
We were talking
ice water with lemon.
Yeah. She sent Morgan a wood.
It's a riser. So like you could put candles on it or vases.
It's really fucking cute.
So cute.
She sent us both candles for morning sun. I've never smelled anything like that before. Other than like in a perfume.
That is refreshing.
That
and like I want to light it in my bath and take a bath right every morning.
And I don't know that if I would have saw that scent that I would have gotten that scent.
Right.
Because anything that has rose in it, I'm typically kind of turned off because sometimes rose is a hit or miss for me. So when Morgan opened it and shoved it in my face, smell this. I was like, oh, you got to get a whiff right now. So I get a whiff of it and I'm like, it is the perfect. It is
so stunning. Smell.
Also she sent me this little vase, a little vase. Every room in my house is like you're entering a different version of my personality.
It's a theme.
Yeah, it's so different.
We're all themed.
The front,
like a breakout room.
I swear to God, the vase, I was like, it fits every single room. Anyways, so just so you know, you're going to be doing all of our homes for the rest of time, babe.
For the rest of time.
No, really.
Check her out, for real. And then we saw Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Jesus.
Marvel? I hate you.
What the literal fuck were you on, Marvel?
I have never been so undecided in a movie.
It was truly one of the best Marvel movies
emotionally
I've ever seen. The flow of all of the stories were perfect. The way that they unfolded the events that happened in the show and then the emotional pulls on every single storyline, it was insane.
Every time I come across a clip from the new movie, I have to sit there and watch it. And I always am like...
Me and Morgan were fighting for our fucking lives over some baby raccoons, okay? Just so we know.
We were all the animals. We were being crazy.
No, it was so sad.
And you know what I've listened to on repeat? Dog Days Are Over. On repeat every morning.
Best song in history.
And I just catch myself dancing like Groot like them. And Rocket.
This song is such an emotional song.
Yeah, it is.
You never get tired of that song. Let's just put it like that. If you don't know this song or every lyric of this song.
The intro of it came on and it was just a couple beats and Taylor whispers, I love this song. And I'm like, I don't even know what it is yet. And she's like, I love this song.
I love this song. That song comes on and I'm just like, you know, when you're trying to find a song, you just hit all shuffle and you're just beep, 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 beaming through. If that comes on, boom, that's what I'm listening to that day.
I love it. Anyways, guys, if you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up
and let's get creepy. Before we get started, we just wanted to remind you that it's that time of year again. Spring is in full swing and summer is just around the corner.
The kids are out of school and all up in your business. Or if you're anything like us, everyone you know is getting married.
During this prime spring season, you need wholesome, convenient meals to keep yourself energized for these warmer, more active days and keep you on track for your hot girl summer.
Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, can help you fuel up fast with their ready-to-eat meals that are delivered straight to your door. With Factor, you will save time, be eating good, and have all of the energy to tackle that never-ending to-do list to completion every single day.
They offer over 34 chef-prepared, dietitian-approved weekly options, aka there is always something new that you can try. Not to mention, if you are a snack queen like me, you can round out your meal and replenish your snack supply with their assortment of 45-plus add-ons. We're talking breakfast items. Like, they're stunning. Apple cinnamon pancakes, bacon and cheddar egg bites, or the potato bacon and egg breakfast skillet.
You had me at potato.
Or for an easy wellness boost, you can try their cold pressed juices, shakes, and smoothies. And they even offer convenient options to add more protein to your meals. Everything from salmon fillets to chicken wings. Factor meals are made to support your dietary goals any time of the day.
Y'all know that we have a jam-packed summer planned, and that means fixing up the budget to ensure that we can afford to live our best lives, like cutting back on takeout. Factor is an amazing option because not only is it cheaper than takeout, but their meals are ready faster than any restaurant delivery, literally just 2 minutes.
Slay.
With Factor, you can rest assured you are making a sustainable choice. They offset 100% of their delivery emissions to your door, source 100% renewable electricity for their production sites and offices, and feature sustainably sourced seafood in their meals.
This May, get Factor and enjoy clean eating without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered to your door, ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess.
Head to factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 and use code creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off of your first box.
That's code creepsandcrimes50 at factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off your first box.
Thank you, Factor, for sponsoring today's episode. Now back to getting creepy.
Hi, friends. I'm Cameron Rogers, host of Freckles Beauty and Friends podcast, which is now on Dear Media. Are you wondering what just happened to your life after having a baby or struggling with your mental health during postpartum? That was me just a few months ago. Are you working on healing your relationship with yourself, your body, and or food? Same. We are all on a journey to self-love and acceptance, and I'm right there with you. That's what Freckles Beauty and Friends is all about, reminding you that no matter what, you are not alone. Make sure to tune in for season 5 launching with Dear Media on November 9th and subscribe to listen to new episodes every Wednesday morning.
Okay, Morgan, what do you have for us today?
Okay, so today I'm going to be discussing something called Unit 731, and a huge, massive trigger warning for today's segment. I will be discussing physical and psychological abuse, rape, and child abuse. It's bad, guys. So if you're not in for this, then jump ahead 25, 30 minutes.
It's really
It's rough. So I'm just going to jump right into it.
All right, I'm ready.
World War II was, as we know, a devastating, disgusting period of our history here on Earth, where it was arguably a war on humanity. The main focal point of World War II, when you think about it, was Germany, Hitler, Nazis, and those poor souls that lost their lives in concentration camps. It was a genocidal war. But unfortunately, there was another war on humanity taking place in a different part of the world that played the horrific games right under everyone's nose. This was Unit 731, where progress, in quotations, as they'd say, was built on the suffering of human beings that were held captive. Unit 731 was a biological chemical warfare research facility under the order of the Imperial Japanese Army. It was located in what is now Harbin, northeast China, but what was then a puppet state of Japan called Manchukuo. And a puppet state means it is a legally recognized independent state, but it is completely dependent upon an outside power, and in this case was Japan. And because of that dependency, the puppet state is subject to that outside power's orders. So an area in China owned and operated by Japan. Japan had occupied this area because of the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931. And when biological weapons were banned by the Geneva Convention in 1925, Japan saw an opportunity. Because of the ban, they reasoned that this only verified its effectiveness as a weapon. So they were like, fuck that ban. Let's find out what everyone else already seems to know. Like they were like on the outside of,
right?
Like there was a big secret being held. And this then started their biological weapons program in 1930, 5 years after the Geneva Convention ban. And Manchuria to the Imperial Army was the perfect place to them. And this is that area in now China. It was a distance away from their island country. They didn't have to risk their own citizens as a result of testing. And they had access, quote, to, quote, as many Chinese individuals as they wanted for their experiments. To them, those living in the town of Harbin and surrounding areas were viewed as a no-cost research subject. And they viewed this as an advantage to get ahead of the world in studying biological warfare. In 1931, Surgeon General Shiro Ishii was placed in command of the AEPRL, or the Army Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory. Surgeon General Ishii was the chief medical officer of the Imperial Japanese Army, and his first order of business was creating a secret research group called the Togo Unit, or the Togo. I'm assuming Togo. This entire thing was Ishii's idea. He had spent 2 years studying Western countries abroad, aka probably us, and he argued that if they could still develop their own programs after the Geneva Convention, then why can't we? And his main man, his number one supporter of this idea, was Colonel Chikahiko Kazumi, who later ended up being Japan's health minister for 4 years.
Wow.
And this wasn't Colonel Kazumi's first rodeo with biological weapons. In 1915, during World War I, he and other imperial members were impressed by the successful German use of chlorine gas. And from this, he and those others joined a secret poison gas committee. So you have these two fuckers leading the pack.
Great.
Once the Togo unit was established, they moved into the Zhongma Fortress, a prison camp that had already been established and was located about 60 miles from Harbin, China, where Unit 731 would eventually be. And I'm going to call this Zhongma Fortress the Z, because it's just easier.
The
so
Z.
We're going to call it the Z. I don't really know if I'm saying it correctly. So it's the Z. Prisoners that were at the Z or being brought to were your common day criminals, murderers, thieves, and political prisoners. Prior to Togo entering this camp, and again, Togo is that secret group that Ishii created for his project, these prisoners were fed well, considering that it was the early 1900s and they were in jail, with a diet of rice and wheat, meat, fish, and they even got alcohol.
Wow.
And this continued for only 7 days when Togo got there, because they wanted their test subjects to be in normal health. Starting on day 8 after Togo arrived to the Z, and over the course of the next couple weeks or months, timing is unsure, prisoners were deprived of food and water, dehydrated, and drained of all blood. Because that's what they were testing first, was their deteriorating health. This is when the first case of vivisection was ever recorded. Vivisection is gruesome, so take a deep breath before I get into that. Your basic Google search will tell you that vivisection is surgery conducted for experimental purposes on a living organism, typically on animals that have a central nervous system, and they did this to view the internal structure. But that's not what I meant back then. Technically, organ harvesting done on a living person is a form of human vivisection. But today, it is the catch-all term for experimentation on live animals. And if you watch Guardians of the Galaxy, think of Rocket and Lila and Floor and Teats. No.
Shut up.
No, I'm crying. We are going to go more into more detail on the vivisection that took place when we get to discussing Unit 731. Besides humans being neglected, deprived, and vivisected, there were a few recorded cases of prisoners who were deliberately being infected with plague bacteria and other microbes. But this was a prison camp with arguably what we know, real prisoners. And they were immediately not fucking having this. So in 1934, there was a prison break, which immediately jeopardized the facility's secrecy.
Right.
And on top of that, less than a year later, there was an explosion at the Z that led to the shutdown. And many believe that the explosion was from those that broke out, wanting to end the madness for the fellow prisoners that were still there suffering, ruin the army's research, and harm those imperial workers that were there.
Mm-hmm.
And this worked for the time being. There was a pause on the research until Surgeon General Ishii received the go-ahead from the emperor to move his research to Harbin and was given a ton of money to set up a new, much larger, much nicer facility for his work. This was Unit 731, where they were in disguise under the name the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department of the Kuomintang Army. But townspeople knew it as a lumber mill. The first subjects at 731 were volunteers from the army who signed consent forms for medical research in return for financial gain. And it was a little more toned down than it was at the Z. They started out investigating the effects of disease and injury. Most people left alive, some didn't. Until one unit of 731, a research group called Maruto, took their study beyond the bounds of medical ethics. And as it increasingly got worse, less and less volunteers from the army were were signing up. And eventually their volunteers just dried up as a whole. They had none left. So they turned to other means that involved kidnapping local Chinese civilians, men, women, and children. They took any foreigner in their area, which was many nationalities, but majorly Russians.
Wow.
They were trafficking prisoners of war and civilians to Unit 731. And it was at this point in time that the concept of consent didn't exist. I'm going to be roughly going over what happened to these victims, and even doing so lightly without sharing the details feels like a disservice to those that lost their lives. I actually contemplated not covering this entire segment, but Taylor told me we do what we do to inform people of the things that they may not have any idea about. And unfortunately, this is one of those things. So please brace yourself, as this is a horrific war crime on humanity. As soon as someone entered 731, they were no longer human. As a matter of fact, they were referred to as logs. This nickname for these people was originated from a joke from the staff, because the surrounding town, like I said, thought their facility was a lumber mill. And they would joke the workers and say at the end of each day how many logs fell. And for the next 14 years, Japanese forces would continue to research, study, and dehumanize citizens from really anywhere. This is when it gets hard to hear. Vivisection carried from the Z Fortress into 731, and it was barbaric. They mutilated bodies without anesthesia on living people. Thousands of men and women who were being held captive were infected with cholera and the plague intentionally. And they then had their organs removed for examination to study the effects of the disease without the decomposition that occurs after death. In order to observe the process of, I believe it's pronounced gangrene, which is dead tissue caused by lack of blood flow or infection. They would amputate these people's limbs and reattach them to the other sides of their body. Some victims had their stomachs removed and their esophagus attached to their intestines, and they were awake, guys. Parts of organs such as the brain, lungs, liver were removed from others to study blood loss. Some limbs remained attached and were crushed, frozen, or had the circulation cut off. A physiologist that worked at 731, his name was Yoshimura Hisato, was there to study hypothermia. He would routinely submerge people's limbs into a tub of water that was filled with ice. And that limb was submerged until it had either frozen solid or until it had a coat of ice forming over top of the skin.
Oh my God.
And then he tried to reverse his hypothermia with different methods of immediately removing it from the cold water and submerging it into boiling water, or holding it on an open fire, or just leaving that person to suffer overnight untreated just to study how long it took for that person's body to thaw out that limb. And it only gets worse. While they were fucking medically with humans, they also used them as a firing range to study the effectiveness of their new weapons and to study wound patterns, how large they were, how deep they went, and if they were effective in killing a captive human or not. Humans, men, women, and children were lined up together by the hundreds and were attacked from various ranges by pistols, rifles, machine guns, grenades, swords, knives, flamethrowers, and the use of gas chambers. They also studied crush injuries by dropping heavy objects onto people who were tied up. They studied dehydration to see how long you could live without water. They studied food deprivation to see how long you could live without food. Some were only able to drink seawater to also study dehydration. And other victims were injected with other people's blood, or sometimes animal blood, to study transfusion process and clotting. They did prolonged X-ray exposure, which sterilized many of their victims. And not only did they do that, but they also inflicted burns on their genitalia with hot plates.
Oh my fuck.
They studied G-forces by placing these victims into large human-sized centrifuges, and they spun them faster and faster until they lost consciousness or died. And this specific study was actually aimed more towards the children, because they had a lower tolerance for acceleration forces.
Fuck.
And they studied syphilis. And I don't even want to say this, so huge trigger warning right now. I'm going to be using the R word. But they ordered those who had syphilis to rape, both men and women. And those victims of rape were then studied and monitored throughout the onset of contracting it until they died. If first exposure or the first time they were raped failed to infect them with syphilis, they were continually raped until they showed signs of infection.
Wow.
And this started a whole new obsession. And that obsession was with women bearing children at Unit 731. Female captives who were at childbearing age were forcefully impregnated. They then, while carrying a child, were subject to the horrific tests that I spoke about above, which were the crush test, the weapon test, the various diseases, the hypothermia test, the syphilis test, the bullet wounds, etc. And they were then opened up so that these researchers could study the effects on the fetuses, and again, without anesthesia.
Whoa.
It gets worse.
That's like a fucked up level of just pure
evil.
Evil.
Absolute like evil. They did all of these horrible things, but literally for why?
No, for what?
Their goal, their mission was to develop a horrific weapon of mass destruction. They wanted to breed the most lethal strings of biological weapons possible. They wanted to wipe out areas in China and Japan that were overpopulated. For them, this was the, I think it's pronounced Yersinia pestis, which is a pathogen and causes bubonic and pneumonic plague and typhus.
What the f-
But on the sidelines of Yersinia pestis was anthrax, smallpox, and cholera. Once developed into what they thought was the strongest, researchers then took their work out in the field, targeting hungry children and homeless parents, offering them food and candy that was laced with these lethal pathogens, hoping that it would spread person to person to eliminate the poverty population. They then advanced to aerial drops, where the army would fly planes over Chinese towns and villages and release highly infectious disease pathogens directly onto crops and into the water supply. But Unit 731 wasn't the only facility. There was Unit 100, or known as the Kuangtung Army Military Horse Epidemic Prevention Workshop.
Horse epidemic.
There was Unit 516, which was known as the Kuangtung Army Technical Testing Department. There was Unit 1855 in Beijing, Unit EI 1644 in Nanjing. I think that's how you say that. Unit 8604 in Gangshua, and Unit 9420 in Singapore. There was more. And they were all eager to jump and conduct on the human experimentation with the army's strong and very large financial backing. It's unclear if the Soviet got word or how people found out. We assume that they got word, but the Red Army was coming for them, Japan, mm-hmm. and fast. Each unit had abandoned the facility quickly, and the ministry in Tokyo ordered the destruction of all incriminating materials. During this time, there were 300 remaining prisoners at Unit 731, who were gassed or fed poison. And there was also 600 Chinese laborers there that worked for them who were shot, lined up and shot.
Wow.
Surgeon General Ishii ordered every member of the group to disappear, like the scientists and the researchers, to disappear, go their own ways, and quote, take the secret to the grave. Workers that were sent to disappear were given potassium cyanide vials to be used in case they were ever captured.
Holy shit.
And before the Red Army came, Ishii's troops blew up the compound to destroy any and all evidence. By 1945, the Empire of Japan had surrendered to the Allied nations that won World War II. They were then basically, I didn't know this, occupied by the United States.
Yeah.
And I wish I could say this gets better, but it doesn't. And it sure doesn't look good for us. After World War II, Nazi Germany physicians were taken to trial for their war crimes. Their names and crimes were publicized.
Right.
But Japan's crimes were hidden. By any guesses? Hi. The United States.
Yep.
Who offered immunity to those involved in their biological weapons program for information on what they learned.
Morgan, I was about to say to you, and I've said this in the past, if any advancement, point blank period, no matter if it's medical, technological, so on and so forth, evolutionary, it does not fucking matter. If any advancement is ever made because of this sort of shit, it will continue to fucking happen because they're like, it doesn't matter if we get caught, our name's still on it for the rest of time. Your name should never be able to be connected to it. It should still have to go through massive amounts of testing, and it should be told to the public, hey, the reason we learned how to fix hypothermia, or we know that you can't lay in the fucking
x-ray
when you're pregnant, is because of this fucking testing. Why the fuck do we not have the privy to that?
And all of our eyes are on every other country, but like, what do we know about the United States? What MK Ultra? Like that, like, I mean, I have sympathy for the victims of MK Ultra, of course, absolutely. So, and like, we know that we have this test. We know that
we know that it's happened.
And we know we did it.
But the point of it. Okay, so me and Morgan were on the phone last night discussing this, like she said, where she was struggling with, do I even go forward with this? Or at what point do we as like podcasters draw the line of what's too much and what's educational? But one of the things in this conversation that we talked about was,
why are we portrayed like in our history classes?
These heroes.
Why are we portrayed as the U.S. like just a little girl in little pigtails sucking on her lollipop while the whole rest of the world's blown up, but the U.S. is innocent?
And then we come in with like
I would love to know like an outside perspective, like what do you guys know? Like
what are you guys taught? On the flip side though, some classic US shit, being aware that it's going on, allowing it to continue to happen, not on our grounds, not on our soil,
but doing what I'm about to tell you what they're doing to get 100%.
So that's the only other way, unless there were literally similar things going on here,
we would never know about it.
We will probably not ever learn of it. Sorry.
No, you're good. So basically, this was a double standard. The war crimes that were done by Nazi Germany, they were put on trial. But the war crimes that were done by the Imperial Army, they were hushed aside by the U.S. offering immunity because the United States had occupied Japan.
Right.
And this was because in 1947, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces wrote to Washington to inform the U.S. that, quote, additional data, possibly some statements from Ishii, Surgeon General, can probably be obtained by informing Japanese involved that information will be retained in intelligence channels and will not be employed as war crimes evidence. And that's from the commander of the Allied forces.
Jesus.
The United States held a very quiet tribunal in Yokohama in 1948. And this, they actually did indict 9 Japanese physician professors and medical students that conducted vivisection on captured American pilots. So once there was an American involved, they got involved. 2 of the 9 were sentenced to death and others received 15 to 20 years of imprisonment. And again, this is because America occupied Japan at the time that they could have that tribunal.
Can you imagine being a prisoner of war? What happened to prisoners of war?
No. Even though it was publicly silent, it wasn't for long. In 1949, a year after the United States held their tribunal, the Soviet Union pursued and prosecuted 12 top military leaders and scientists from 731 and its affiliated Unit 1644 and Unit 100. Among that group was the commander-in-chief of the million-man Kwantung Army, General Otozo Yamada. But it is also believed that Japan shared information with the Soviets for judicial leniency. One sick fuck from Unit 1644 named Masami Kitoka continued to perform experiments on unwilling Japanese victims from 1947 to 1956. After leaving Unit 1644, he was hired on at Japan's National Institute of Health Sciences. There, he infected patients with rickettsia and typhus. Rickets.
What?
And typhoid fever, basically.
Fuck.
And the head honcho, Surgeon General Ishii, was granted immunity from prosecution for war crimes by the American occupation authorities because he had provided human experimentation research to them. After the end of the American occupation in the 50s, discussion began about Japan's activity, specifically Unit 731. They remained silent until about 1990. When for the first time acknowledged the existence of 731 publicly.
Wow.
But still refused to discuss what had happened there. In 2002, Tokyo courts acknowledged that 731 was involved with biological warfare research. And in 2006, a nurse who had worked in a medical school came forward stating that the school belonged to Unit 731 during World War II. And she worked there. And she revealed that she had helped bury bodies and pieces of bodies on the school's ground. In response to her statement, the Ministry of Health began to excavate the site in 2011. And the Chinese government requested for DNA samples to identify human remains, skulls, and bones. But Japan rejected this request, and it is still rejected today.
Are you fucking kidding?
In 2018, Japan disclosed the name of 3,607 members that were involved via working in Unit 731, and it is estimated that Japan's biological warfare operations were the largest during World War II. An estimated 200,000 to 300,000 people were killed in Unit 731. And it's estimated that more than 2,000 civilians died of the plague following the unit's endgame. And yet another 1,000 people died from the plague after it was spread by the railroad into a different town. And an estimated 6,000 more are believed to have died by the use of biological weapons, anthrax, typhoid, etc., by the hands of Unit 731. And ultimately, to this day, the Japanese Imperial Army got away with it. Unit 731, what remains after the bombing, stands as a museum to honor those who were subject to these horrific war crimes. And the main hall there is lined with hundreds of portraits and firsthand testimonies of guards that didn't believe in what was happening, but were ordered to be there and to serve. Of course, there are no testimonies of any victims because none made it out. And that is Unit 731.
All right.
I just like,
fuck everybody.
Why don't we learn about that?
Because we had a dirty hand in it.
Yeah.
That's why we're so fucking taught.
We hushed it up so we could get information.
If you need your millionth reason as to why war is not good at all and no one should ever want war with anyone, here's your millionth reason. It is such a protected, hardcore, ironclad cover for any fucked up shit for fucked up people to do.
Yep.
Crime is at an all-time high. Organized crime at an all-time high. Medical crimes, all-time high.
And what sucks, war on humanity, it is something that needs to be discussed because it should not be overlooked.
You should be educated about this. Hundreds of thousands
of people lost their lives at the hands of medical research. I can't even argue that that is medical research. It's fucking not. Their cover names, like epidemic prevention, like that's literally our CDC.
That's literally what I was about to
say. And I do want to make ourselves clear here. We're not taking away by any means any victims of the Holocaust.
No, we're just explaining.
Using it as, I don't even like saying that, but like using it as a scale to show the masses of this project or this horrific war crime that was going on at the same exact time.
At the same exact time.
How many more things like this is out there?
No, it's horrible. Oh my God. That is so fucked.
Yeah. But my thong is riding up my ass. So I'm over my story. Thanks for listening. Sorry, guys. And Taylor, you're up.
Okay, my turn. Because Morgan was covering all of the horrific shit, I did more of a unsolved straight up mystery. Like straight up mystery that Morgan sent me from the East Tennessee Crime Unsolved Mysteries Facebook group.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. This is an East Tennessee local one.
I love it.
Interesting. I've never heard of it before. Like when she sent it to me, I was like, I've never heard of that. Yeah.
I saw it. I said, oh, she needs to cover that.
100%. And it was so confusing that there's so much on it because people are literally just like mind blown about this.
Yeah.
Okay. On the morning of Thursday, July 11th, 1996, at 7:30 a.m., two construction workers arrived at their job site in Strawberry Plains, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. So Strawberry Plains is like north,
Knox,
east, like right above Knoxville. Just know at this point in time, this was mainly just like an exit. In this parking lot of the Fairfield Inn on Strawberry Plains Pike, they go to their job site and they were renovating the hotel, the Fairfield Inn, and just kind of like still letting people be in it, expanding on it, so on and so forth. But it just really was a normal day showing up for work. It was just a Thursday. They didn't have Creeps and Crimes back then, or I'm sure they would have been listening. As these two construction workers entered their job site, they spotted what looked like a man, half naked, sleeping on their job site on his stomach with his shoes as a pillow. The man's shirt was open, like it was a button down that had been unbuttoned, and his pants were pulled down, like around his ankles. His socks and a few other clothing pieces laying nearby him. And so they're like, okay, maybe this is someone who's unhoused that just slept here, or someone that got drunk walking back from the bar and passed out, somehow ended up in our job site, which are locked up, passed out there. So they start walking to this man and they're like, something's not right. Because the closer and closer they got, it wasn't only his clothing pieces surrounding him. There were thousands of dollars of bills laying around.
What?
Just scattered. And I'm not talking just US dollars. There were $4,000 worth of German, US, and Canadian currency. And they discovered that he was not sleeping. He was dead. The construction workers immediately called police, who rushed to the scene. Around the man's body, investigators also found a black duffel bag that had maps and travel receipts inside, along with a fanny pack that was filled with 5 ounces of gold bars.
Holy shit.
jewelry, keys for a Toyota Corolla, a hotel room key, a pair of sunglasses, and many gold and platinum coins, all of which together totaled in value at $2,000. Through these finds, they were able to identify the man as a Canadian citizen, 31-year-old Blair Adams. Robert Dennis, or Blair Adams, was born on December 28, 1964, in Surrey, British Columbia, Canada. For a career, Blair worked as a foreman at his stepfather's construction company. And in 1995, so the year prior, he had the opportunity to work on a project in Frankfurt, Germany, where he met his girlfriend. And on Friday, July 5, 1996, so just a few days before his body was discovered at this construction site in Knoxville, Tennessee, Blair went to the bank in Surrey and withdrew almost all of the money from his account and then all of the contents of his safety deposit box. He then went to a travel agency and purchased a round-trip flight to Frankfurt, costing him a total of either $1,600 or $1,700, the amounts vary depending on your source, to supposedly visit his girlfriend. However, she had no idea of his trip. Like, it would have been a surprise to her. Well, just hours after purchasing this trip from the travel agency, he returned to the office and requested a refund, saying that the person he was planning to visit had fallen ill and it's just not the right time. But his girlfriend was not sick at all.
And she had no idea.
And she had no idea this was going on. This was not the first time that Blair had exhibited this erratic behavior. It had been going on for a few weeks to maybe even a month at this point. Starting in the early summer months of 1996, Blair was acting out. Now, he had struggled with alcoholism in the past, and for the last 2 years, he had been sober. But his loved ones began to worry when they realized that he had stopped attending his AA meetings with his sponsor. In the beginning, there were just small, odd instances, but nothing too significant. And then he began leaving his construction sites unlocked. This was absolutely out of character for Blair to do, and in general, just not good, something you don't do. And then out of nowhere, with no warning at all, he abruptly quits his job and never even picks up his paycheck. This was the point that everyone in his life began to notice that he was not okay. He began speaking to his girlfriend about this fear that he had, that he was being watched or someone was coming after him, exhibiting these massive signs of unwarranted paranoia. When asked why he felt that he was in danger, he told his mother and girlfriend that a German coworker that he had had in Frankfurt was in Canada and in town, and apparently the two had bad blood. Going on to say that this coworker had also been spreading rumors about him and previously threatened him with violence. But when they asked him to elaborate as to why this person would want to harm him in any way, he would never explain. The day after he bought and refunded this round-trip flight to Germany, which is now Saturday, July 6, 1996, Blair packed up a small bag of belongings and all of the cash and stuff that he had withdrawn from the bank and began making his way to the Canadian-US border entry point on the Pacific Highway from Surrey to Blaine, Washington. Once he got to the checkpoint, immigration officials noticed some pretty obvious scratches on his hands, arms, and legs. This alarmed them. But even more so than that, Blair matched the description of a suspected car thief that had just recently, like minutes before, ditched the stolen car near where he was, like this border crossing point. Well, they couldn't prove or disprove that Blair was their guy, and plus they had no evidence to back this up at all. So police were forced to let him go, but they just would not let him leave Canada. So Blair then got back to his house, got into his car because he hadn't taken his car there. I guess he had taken a taxi and goes back to his house, gets his car, and he drives to the Vancouver airport. At the airport, he rents a Nissan Altima, leaves his car parked at the airport, and begins driving towards the border again.
The same border.
The same border. And this time he was actually successful in crossing, which I'm like, how?
What the fuck are they doing at the border?
So anyways, they let him through now. Blair then drove to the Seattle airport, where he purchased an overnight one-way ticket to Washington, D.C. This is particularly odd because the round-trip ticket would be half the price than what he paid.
And he's from that area.
You're from that. You're going to have to come back here.
Right. Right. I guess you can leave your rental car there, but if you live on that side of Canada, then it would only make sense to come back
that way. You still got to be over there.
Yeah.
So he gets his one-way ticket to Washington, D.C., and he arrives in Washington, D.C. on July 10th and immediately rents a Toyota Corolla or Camry. I wrote Corolla.
Bro loves his Toyota.
I'm pretty positive that it's a Camry, not Corolla. And he began driving to Knoxville, Tennessee. This is a seven-hour car drive from Washington, D.C. to Knoxville. So at around 5:30 p.m., Blair stops at a gas station on Strawberry Plains exit. As he's trying to leave the gas station, his Toyota is not starting. He's either called or spoke with a repair service driver slash tow truck driver about this issue. And this man that he was talking to was like, oh, it's because you're using the wrong key. Like this isn't the key for the car. It's a Nissan Altima key, the first rental car that he had, not a Toyota car. The driver's like, man, you drove all the way here. Like
you've got to have the key.
This isn't like it's a fob that you can just have in the car at this point. It's the actual key.
Right.
So he's like, it's got to be somewhere here. Let's just look for it. Why don't you check your pockets? And Blair like freaks out. He's like, I'm not checking my pockets. I'm not emptying my pockets. No way, no how. I'm not doing it.
What?
So the tow truck driver slash repairman was like, all right, man. Well, then I guess I'm going to have to tow it and try to go right. find
and
you a key.
You know it was gems.
Right. No, really. I swear. That's what I was trying to go. I was like, this got to be gems, right? Yeah. 100%. So the tow truck driver's like, well, where do you want me to drop you off at, man? Because the key's got to be somewhere in this fucking car. I guess I'm going to tow it and go look at it and it's just going to cost
check
you more money.
Check your pockets whenever you want.
Right. So Blair's like, just drop me off at the Fairfield Inn Hotel, which is where his body was later discovered. Blair entered and exited the lobby of the hotel five different times in the span of 40 minutes before going up to the desk and requesting a room.
What?
At this point, he appeared to be very anxious, extremely irritated, and nervous from the CCTV footage that they have. Almost as if he was looking for someone that he knew or was expecting to see someone that he knew, like meeting up with someone, like he was anxious. He paid $100 in cash, but before the front desk worker could give him his change back, he just walks off and goes outside. And
did he at least get the key?
He got the key. So he walks out at 7:37 p.m. And the next time that he was ever seen on CCTV footage by anyone in the hotel, by anyone that's come forward, was when his body was discovered.
So he never went back into the hotel.
Exactly. And we have 12 hours of a time span between the last time that he's seen exactly to the time that his body is discovered, 7:30 p.m. to 7:30 a.m. After reviewing the hotel records and the CCTV footage, it was determined that Blair never once entered his hotel room or came back into the hotel after he paid for his room. An autopsy was performed and reported by the University of Tennessee Medical Center. The ME found that Blair had sustained many cuts and abrasions that were consistent with defensive wounds. There was a large wound to his forehead that was determined to be caused by a crowbar or of a club of some sort. Trigger warning for SA. Also, there were injuries that suggested that Blair could have possibly been sexually assaulted prior, during, or after his death. But more specifically, this was thought because it was clear that his pants had been forcibly pulled down. Weirdly enough, there was also what looked to be road rash, like you would see on a motorcycle accident victim, on his arms and body and like various places on his body, almost as if he had been beaten with a metal bar, stomped on, and maybe even ran over.
My God.
In this construction site. Lastly, it was evident that he had suffered a violent blow to his stomach area, which ruptured organs in his abdomen. However, his official cause of death was ruled sepsis from abdominal perforation.
So whatever wound he had to the stomach was the cause of death, basically.
Right. In his stomach, they discovered lettuce, shrimp, and meat that had not yet been digested, suggesting that he had eaten just before his death. There were no traces of drugs or alcohol in his system, which immediately throws a wrench into this because they're like, then what was causing all of this? Because of the location of Blair's belongings, specifically his ID cards, like his passport, his license, his paperwork, so on and so forth, they believe that these items had been thrown out of a moving car just 100 yards away from his body. In his hand, discovered at the crime scene, investigators found a strand of long hair that was in his grasp, like he was holding on to it, which would be the only DNA evidence ever recovered from the crime scene. The only witness that ever came forward was a security guard from a business nearby who reported hearing a scream at approximately 3:30 a.m. However, the security guard reported that the scream was of a woman, not a man. Investigators were able to contact the tow truck driver slash auto repairman that Blair had spoken with and gotten that ride from the hotel, to the hotel. The man reported that Blair did not seem to be under the influence of anything, drugs or alcohol, but instead, quote, "It was like his mind wasn't functioning correctly for some reason," end quote. I read this interview that was on the Knoxville Sentinel or Knox News from this time. And the person that was interviewed essentially said, like, it was confusing not only for the people around him, but also for him. It was almost like he was like, I don't understand why this mental process isn't working for me.
Yeah, it's like paranoia took over.
Exactly. And he was sane enough to be like, why am I thinking like this?
Yeah.
But not to the point where he could elaborate on it, I guess. Detectives first classified Blair's case as a sex-related crime due to the nature of his injuries and the location of where he was discovered. So that Fairfield Inn is right next to this truck stop, and it is known to be where the truckers meet with their sex workers in this area. But the circumstances surrounding his death did not align with a sex-related crime as a motive. As I said earlier, though there was reason for them to believe that this could be a sex-related crime or that he possibly could have been sexually assaulted, there was no way that they could test to see if he was, because there was no other DNA other than that strand. And from the looks of it all, they could not confirm or deny, is I think the most respectful and best way to put it. They don't know for sure if he was sexually assaulted. They just, due to the nature of the way his body was found and so on and so forth. There was also no suggested or even apparent reason as to why exactly Blair would either be heading through Knoxville to Knoxville as his final destination. Whatever, like, there's no reason he should be in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Right.
He knew no one in East Tennessee. He had no communications with anyone in this area at all.
He know anyone in D.C.?
Not that was known or reported. Then again, which I'll get to this in a little bit, like, think of this time. It's 1996. Like, not everyone had to know who you were talking to.
Right.
So he possibly could have. But from what they uncovered in this entire investigation, they could not find any reason for him to be in these areas. It sounds like he's running from something. So his mother told investigators that the only reason that she could possibly think as to why her son would even be in this area of the floating rock we're all on, much less the United States, was if he was going to the Olympics in Atlanta.
Oh.
Which is an odd situation. However, there was nothing to actually support this theory of hers other than conversations where he was like, I would like to go.
Okay.
Because of this, pretty quickly, the case goes cold. There's no viable leads from anyone. It's pretty much like it stands still from the beginning. There's no way to move forward. There's no evidence at the scene. There's no fingerprints.
Guys, sorry. It's like,
can y'all
really
hear
storming.
The thunder?
Really storming right now.
I mean,
like, I can't even think straight.
I can't pay attention. I'm too scared.
My heart's racing.
I know.
Our power's going to go out, though.
I know. We got to hurry. Okay, here we go. However, there was nothing to really support this theory, and so pretty quickly, the case goes cold. In 1997, Blair Adams' case was featured on season 9 of Unsolved Mysteries in hopes of generating some leads. But it was not until 2010 that some of the most viable leads, and I say that very loosely because the KPD was like, this is the most unreliable, but the most viable one.
Yeah, okay.
And essentially, it was this woman, two women came forward, and they were eating at the Cracker Barrel on the Strawberry Plains exit.
They have shrimp dinners there?
Yes, they do.
Well,
so that would make sense. But they said that they were at the Cracker Barrel eating together on that evening, and they saw Blair Adams inside and then outside speaking with this man. And they created a composite sketch of this man, and it was released in 2010. Nothing came of that. The DNA from the hair that was discovered at the crime scene in Blair's hand is still stored and will hopefully one day be able to be tested and matched with a perpetrator. But it has not been done yet.
Why?
No
just
idea.
Just run it.
I don't understand why it would be such a big deal to just compare it in the database. Because if you have it, unless maybe they like it's too old to fuck around with. But I feel like if we just pull DNA from it and put it in the database, it'd be fine.
Right.
So I'm not really sure. But either way, that's the end of the case, guys. Like, that's the end of the facts. And so clearly, because of this, theories go buck ass wild.
Right.
And there are so many.
My number one is mafia.
Mafia. Literally. So let's just break down some of the main ones. And the most prominent theory is that he had an undiagnosed mental illness based off of his actions in the weeks and months prior to his death, specifically the escalated actions in the days prior to his death. And I just feel like the best way to explain this was written by a Reddit user that I'm going to read for you right now. So this is from the Reddit thread Unsolved Mysteries. And this specific post, the user is deleted, so I can't figure out what their username was, but it was posted 3 years ago. And the title of it is, "I think I might be able to explain the Blair Adams case with personal experiences. I'm just a guest to this subreddit. I'm no expert. I might watch an Unsolved Mysteries video on YouTube once in a while, but I am way out of my jurisdiction here. Yesterday, I came across a video created by YouTuber Lazy Masquerades. He covers multiple rabbit hole mysteries, but Blair Adams caught my attention the most. And I feel like his last days and death have been way blown out of proportion. Adult onset schizophrenia is very rare in children before puberty and rare for a person over the age of 45. Adams was 31 at the time of his death. I'm sure you're all familiar with his case and Adams' very bizarre and strange behaviors that just suddenly appeared one day and all it did was quickly escalate from there. All of the odd behavior that he was documented having from his own mother, who Adams told, quote, someone is spreading rumors about me but never said who, to multiple eyewitnesses in multiple states, including police, all described Adams as crazy, odd, or erratic. Why did he rent multiple cars and drive to seemingly such random places? Well, I have a personal story that I think may shed light on that. My brother is severely mentally ill. Back in 1999, he was having an episode. This was before he was diagnosed, by the way. One day, he thought a barcode on the back of a soda can was telling him to drive to Maine because someone was trying to kill him. And that's exactly what he did. As he was driving, he started reading license plates, and they are telling him to drive to the border of Canada, then Albany, then Jersey. Long story short, the poor guy ended up in a jail cell in goddamn Oklahoma. He had a substantial amount of cash on him, plane tickets, train tickets, and even some of my grandfather's jewelry. When asked why he had so much cash and jewelry on him, he had two simple answers. One, he didn't want anyone to steal it. Two, he needed money to stay on the run from the CIA agents trying to kill him. Duh. Adams had a substantial amount of cash on him. Plane tickets, and jewelry. His death to me also is much more simple as well. Have you ever been in a shady part of town and felt that everyone is watching you? It's because they are. Junkies and thugs prey on the weak, not the strong. They prey on those who are easy to target and not someone who is going to put up a big enough fight. And they get good at finding their targets. The elderly, the drunk, the high, even the mentally ill or disabled. A junkie couple came across a manic Adams while he was in an episode, gained his trust somehow. They were going to simply rob him, but he put up a much bigger fight than they expected. They realized that they were in way over their heads, and probably the second they hit him in the stomach with the crowbar, and then once in the head in the heat of the moment. These were junkies looking to get a fix, not kill a man. So they panicked and they ran. I say it's a couple because Adams had a single strand of long hair in his hand when found, which makes me believe a woman was present. And sorry, but no junkie woman I have ever seen is strong enough to even lift a metal bar, never mind strong enough to kill a man with only two blows. If you Google schizophrenia license plates, for whatever reason, it's a very common thing. Like I said, I am no expert, and I'm not saying I have solved the thing. It's just my own theory. A mentally ill man was having a bad episode, and his luck eventually ran out when he inevitably ran into some shitty people. This happened a long time ago. I don't see how it's impossible. In fact, more than likely, TV shows and the internet made this case and its sequences of events much more extravagant than the reality of the situation. I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, not trying to beat myself off, but I what? I'd like to think I'm fairly street smart. This is not a Disney movie, but also not all drug addicts are junkies or bad people. They are just people trying to deal with personal trauma the best way that they can. But no one is your friend on the streets, especially for an out-of-towner. No one wants to be your friend. No one has good intentions. Mind your own business and keep walking. English is my second language. Sorry for the spelling or the grammar.
I'm with them.
I mean, yeah. That is truly like
Strawberry Plains, like, is the borderline of like North Knox area is.
Yeah, bad. I go into detail about it here in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that way we can go into it together at that point.
Yeah.
Because I find that to be probably what
he
happened.
He was manic.
I mean, you see people like Bryce's Pizza in cases like this where people just go missing and there's no reasonable explanation for it, or they wind up dead for the most part, especially in men that are, you know, 20s and 30s. Yes, 30s is a little bit later, but anything, it's not right. Mental health is not a guideline book that is easy to follow. It's not a strict line. So it wouldn't be too wild to think that. So the next one is, just like he alluded to, a robbery gone wrong. This would make much more sense, but only if at least the U.S. money had been taken. Some speculate that he was jumped while walking back to the hotel from eating dinner somewhere. And whoever it was that jumped him, likely two people because of his injuries and what they found at the scene, did not realize that he was as strong as he was or would be as capable of fighting them as he was. And they accidentally killed him in this struggle. This area of Knoxville, Strawberry Plains, was not built up or considered a super nice slash safe area until 10 years ago at most.
Yeah.
Like, and
even today, like, that exit area mm-hmm. is still borderline. Like, you have weird. To get off of Strawberry Plains exactly. to find the nice area. The exit area is still borderline.
And for the most part, it was up until this point, and still today, you're saying it's mainly just a good pull-off exit for truckers. And the reason it was even expanded and turned into what it is to now is because Knoxville was growing at a rapid rate, still is growing at a rapid rate, and they needed a place to expand the nicer parts of Knoxville, because what Morgan was saying prior to this was that area between on the interstate, the last Knoxville exit, like downtown Knoxville exit, and the Strawberry Plains exit, that area is considered very dangerous. Crime rates are very, very high. The homes are less valuable in the Knoxville area, even with the market being what it is today, because of the crime rates in this area.
Yeah.
If that just gives you any insight.
You know, I think I've stayed at that Fairfield Inn my freshman year.
Okay.
Before we knew anything about Knoxville, I'm pretty sure that was the hotel we stayed in before we moved in. And we knew nothing about the area, but the exit's nice.
Right. You know? It's a nice exit.
For probably up until my junior year, my mom would always stay at that exit.
I was about to say, doesn't your mom always stay at Strawberry Plains?
Now she goes down to Cedar Bluff. Yeah. Up until we didn't know. Like right. even in college, like I didn't know about
right.
North Knox. And like my mom liked that exit. She had there's a Weigel's there.
Yeah.
Taco Bell.
There's a big Weigel's.
She could get her Coke Icy. Yep. Like, she was content.
There's a Waffle House, yeah. Taco Bell, and something else.
I think there's a Speedway gas station too, which is what she loves.
That's what I pulled off for to get gas the other day.
Yeah.
When I was driving up to Dandridge.
Yeah. So I think I've literally stayed in that hotel.
You probably fucking have.
Multiple times. Yeah.
Okay. So that's it for the robbery gone wrong. And it's really just an extension of what he said with us explaining the area to you. So then the third theory is that it was an organized crime hit. Maybe there really was someone after him. Maybe he messed with the wrong person or accidentally got himself into something that he shouldn't have or saw something that he shouldn't have seen. If this was the doing of an organized crime group, it would make sense as to why the money was left behind, number one, why there were so many different currencies there, number two, and three, why his pants were pulled down. Now, I do not want this to be taken wrong, but like I said, it was only suggested that he was essayed because of his pants pulling down and like some smaller injuries that could also be from him falling on his back at this point in time. However, like I said, there was nothing to prove or disprove that he had been essayed during this attack. So I'm not going to say that he wasn't. I'm not going to say that he was. I'm just giving you a theory. I don't want to seem like I'm taking away, because I feel like if this was a woman, it'd be a very different conversation, whether it was implied or not. Like I said, I'm just saying this is a theory. If his pants were pulled down without him being essayed, why would someone do that?
Right.
What would be the purpose of pulling someone's pants down? It's a form of humiliation.
Yeah.
Also, his shoes being under his head like a pillow, investigators said that they looked as if they had like been drugged to go underneath his head either by him or by someone else. Now, if this was the doing of another person, it would be a really weird gesture after brutally beating someone to death to make sure that they had a pillow to rest their head on
yeah.
while they sat there and
he died by sepsis. So he was alive.
When they left. If this was the doing of another person, that would just be really weird, but it would be consistent with the humiliation tactics of organized crime. All of this to say that there is no evidence whatsoever that Blair had ever crossed paths with any organized crime groups in any way in the past at all. It's just odd pieces of evidence that suggest that there was something a little bit more like this.
Mm-hmm.
The next theory is that maybe he was meeting up with someone. So much of this case seems personal. So much about his death seems personal. Though there is no known reason as to why he would have been in Knoxville, it's 1996. So really, how would we know if he was talking to someone in secret, that someone he wanted to keep in secret?
Right.
Some people believe that the rumors that this German coworker of his was spreading was that he was seeing a man or possibly had a relationship with that coworker while in Germany. This is not proven. I find it semi-homophobic when cases bring this up, mainly because, especially in cases like this, because why is the first thought that, oh, he was gay?
Right.
That's why he had to be killed. Like,
right.
And why is it only unsolved murders? Anyways, so I don't want y'all to feel like that's what I'm saying or just that's what we're doing. It's just one of the theories that is talked about a lot. If he was coming up to Knoxville to meet up with someone, it would explain the personal aspects of the attack. I find it very odd that he was brutally beaten, because for someone to have that much power to hurt someone and want to hurt someone, there's passion behind it. And also, this seems like a case of overkill. And the fact that his attackers took the time to somewhat humiliate him by pulling down his pants or even placing the shoes under his head, like, again, personal. And then also, what do we know about weapons that various attackers use? A gun is when you want to have like a third degree connection with your, you don't want to have a connection at all, really, right, with your victim.
Personal.
A knife is if you do. And then an object where you're brutally beating that person, that is extremely personal. That's 1 degree. That's less than 1 degree.
I also feel like his path to get to Knoxville could have been like, I need to do this without a trace. I need to meet this person. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do this
My way. And that could go for either the mafia, organized crime situation, all the way down to just maybe seeing someone.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a random attack, why would someone leave behind so much money?
Yeah.
Gold bars and things that are virtually untraceable, leaving those behind.
Right. That's it's what just doesn't make odd. Sense to me.
Right. Like nothing was stolen from him.
Right. A junkie is going to take that.
Exactly. If this was a junkie, like the Reddit user was saying. The next one is the last one. And anyone that's from the Knoxville area, this one I found in a comment. And the second I saw it, it clicked for me.
Uh-oh.
Trafficking.
Yeah.
Sex or drug. The only other target crime related theory, meaning like he was targeted for some unknown reason, there is trafficking. Knoxville is known for sex and drug trafficking because of its location. It sits at the crossroads of various interstates and highways, but more specifically, two major ones, I-75, that's north to south, I-40, that runs east to west. With the Strawberry Plains exit being just out of the city, but literally a 15 to 20 minute drive either direction from the major crossing points of these two interstates and a massive truck stop, would it be so far-fetched to believe that Blair just accidentally, in a series of incredibly unfortunate events, walked up on a trafficking trade drop-off conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Really, his only purpose for being in Knoxville, if this was the case, was to sleep and get on the road again the next day, possibly to Atlanta, possibly to who knows where. This would explain his manner of death and the fact that he was not robbed of any of his belongings and the mystery that surrounds the entire thing. But also, it would explain the woman's scream that was heard by the security guard.
Because he watched that.
Yes. So maybe Blair was walking to his hotel room or just on a late night walk after eating dinner or just needing to clear his head and witnessed a woman being taken and tried to step in and help, or witnessed a trade-off and tried to step in and help. Though this does not explain any of the events leading up to his death, it would explain the mystery surrounding the location and the randomness and the brutal manner, plus the fact that he wasn't robbed, surrounding his death. I was reading this on a Reddit thread, like I said, and it clicked to me. And they were discussing various theories, and I came across this comment from Miss Scarlet the Harlot, don't know.
All right, Miss Scarlet.
And it was on that same thread that I read the first one from, and these are going to be linked. And this is what it says. I'm surprised that I seem to be a part of the very small minority here that thinks that he wasn't paranoid and someone was actually after him. The whole scenario, the coincidence of him being murdered when it just so happens that he had this all of a sudden mental break out of nowhere in his life involving thinking that someone was out to kill him, the extent of his injuries being way beyond what you would expect from self-defense or a random fight or even a mugging, the money strewn about, so on and so forth, just requires way too many weird coincidences and unlikely scenarios scenarios to try and steer away from the simplest answer, which is that someone was indeed after him and that someone got him. A paranoid schizophrenic might not have trusted anyone at home with his whereabouts, but someone who was not paranoid and just truly scared of a very real threat likely would. Odds are that he royally pissed off someone with some serious connections, and that someone leaned on whoever back in Surrey they suspected that he would stay in contact with and got his whereabouts from them. It's not like there were no organizations involved in drug trade with members or at least connections in both Canada or the US. I doubt anyone went to that extent to kill him and leave money all over some drug debt. But if he was robbed by the wrong person or slept with someone's wife or did something that went beyond money, that might be our answer.
Mm-hmm.
So he did something that was beyond money or found something that was beyond money.
I mean, that is so right. Like, how often is it that episodic breaks happen and you're also murdered during it?
Right. Like, how personally, how rare is that?
Yeah.
Like, and literally murder.
And paranoia, like, with remove the schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
paranoia can eat a person alive.
Yes,
it
absolutely.
It can show signs of schizophrenia.
Right.
And that's where he's getting, what is going on with me? But like, he's so scared and his brain is so paranoid that he is running to and from every which way.
Exactly. And so off of this, like, further down on the thread, it was also suggested that he possibly could have gone to Knoxville. Like, if not, okay, because we haven't even talked about this. What if Knoxville was his end game?
Mm-hmm.
Where, what if he, his entire point of this entire destination, this entire roundabout way was to get to Knoxville? That would not explain the first plane tickets to Germany, but maybe he was told that he needed to go to Germany to do something. And then at the last second said, scratch that. I got to get into the United States because I got to go to Knoxville, Tennessee. If that was the case, why would Knoxville be his end game? Maybe he needed to pay a debt. And this person very well explained it. So it says, okay, so this is from that same thread. And this is from Always Offended 88. Posted 9 months ago. During one period a few decades ago, now before cell phones and related tracking, we had some of our domestic violence safe houses compromised by hit teams hunting one of our escaping victims. We were evacuating and relocating the victim repeatedly in rapid succession, but the hit teams just kept finding her at new locations, then stalking the new locations and that victim, harassing everyone concerned. They were so fast and effective that the recorded landlord of one of the locations was getting harassed and threatening calls about this anonymous victim, even as the victim and her belongings were being unloaded from the truck. Already,
wow.
They knew where she was. There is a determined unwillingness among an awful lot of folks to recognize just how organized and obsessive organized crime can and will be to carry out both hard and soft hits, even on peripheral people, such as an uninvolved domestic partner of one of its members. There is likewise blindness to just how much of the culture of a cult extremist lies at the foundation and the heart of all these organized crime rings, as well as the confederacy that can loosely yet effectively link these rings together. In the case written by the OP, which is the Blair Adams case, we see both direct and circumstantial evidence of a very real threat to his life. His awareness of the possible threat, his actions to escape and evade the threat, possibly some of his history with drug crime. These specifics aren't laid out or well known enough to reasonably infer his own personal involvement or remotest ties to organized crime. That's just a side note. His choices of destination, he traveled from one hub of organized drug crimes and human sex trafficking crimes to another, and his ultimate brutal murder. From what was written, we also see no substantial evidence in any form of mental illness. But for the OP's direct accusation of the clinical diagnosis of paranoia in the title and the write-up, that accusation is more than enough to draw out the mental illness assumption bandwagon brigade. That does not mean that mental illness can be ruled out. It only sounds like in extreme stress, though, as one might experience fleeing ahead of a hit. However, having fled from one organized crime, sex, and drug trafficking hub to another, it would easily have been a case of trusting the wrong person for help to escape that hit. They wouldn't have been able to track every single one of his moves, though they might actually have been able to if you have seen the access to real-time databases that such rings demonstrated even decades ago. You wouldn't miss the possibility. That's crazy.
That's scary.
The man he was seeing the night before his murder, I've never heard of that. It wasn't any of my research.
No, the man he was seeing the night before.
The man he was seen with.
At Cracker Barrel.
Cracker Barrel guy. The man that he was seen with at Cracker Barrel the night before his murder could have been the wrong person in contact known to him, and could also have been the pimp that the police have theorized beat him to death. By the time he reached his contact, word of the hit could have been put out on him, and they arrived well ahead of him. I can imagine that the man offering him the stress relief services of one of the trafficked girls or victims who may have witnessed the murder and screamed, and then the woman that he was sleeping with who screamed offered the victim some comfort, such as the shoes to lay his head on as he died.
Oh.
You wouldn't see that trafficked witness used as a honey trap coming forward knowing that she would be next if she did. We eventually identified some of the leaking sources that compromised so many of the safe houses in such rapid succession, but IIRC, we didn't think that we had found all of them. It could have been devastatingly surprising for many folks to learn what data and homicidal maniacs and organized crime can gain access to in real time. It is why we keep all of our survivors anonymous, that best and first protects them.
Damn.
Right.
I don't know, dude. I don't know anymore, because I don't want to take away from, you know, what if it was just a mental illness, but it's right. Too fucking personal to me.
I don't want to take away from the fact that it possibly could have been him experiencing an episode of undiagnosed mental illness, and the way that it came on so fast, like just out of nowhere. That's what the family said. Like, one day he was his normal self and the next day he wasn't, and they all described him as like this super gentleman, like kind soul, friendly, always willing to give a helping hand, a happy-go-lucky dude, like always very positive. And then some of his coworkers in Germany said that that wasn't the case, that he was extremely defensive, always willing to get in an argument, get in a fight. He was someone totally different. So in my opinion, if that's how he was acting while he was in Germany, but in being at home, not ever acting like that, then maybe there was a real threat with someone from Germany.
Right.
And there's no telling if this was an organized crime hit, exactly what this person was saying, if he went to go to somewhere that he thought was safe and then that person had sold him out.
Right.
And again, if they were like, you know, let's go eat at the Cracker Barrel, chill out, and then we can go back and I've got a girl that you can hook up with, so on and so forth. And
keep him occupied, keep him in the same place at once.
Right. And again, this is the parking lot of the Fairfield Inn. So maybe he was hooking up with this girl in the Fairfield Inn, ripped out of the car. She screams at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
The security guard hears it. And basically what
I don't know why they haven't ran the hair.
Me either. Basically, what the KPD says about it to this day is that truly the only way that they believe that this case would, there'd be a reason behind it, an explanation, and like for it to be truly solved is if you ran the fucking DNA, by the way, number one.
Number one.
But they say number two is that if someone came forward about it, which they find very unlikely.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, for them to think that they have to believe that this is the result of
the unspoken.
Exactly. Yeah. The whole like trafficking situation like really does.
Yeah.
Like
it made me remember. Do you remember that time? I think we were maybe seniors when they found that van under the bridge.
I was just thinking that. Yep.
Guys, they found a van. So this is probably 10 minutes from Strawberry Plains at a location where all of our bars are.
Where we go out.
To this day. It was a van parked under a bridge, like under the underpass. It had, you lifted it up and it was just like a piece of plywood.
Right.
When you like, it was one of those moving vans. So you could lift the trunk, like slide it up and down. Well, when they removed that piece of plywood, they found like 6 cots, chains. They were like built in as like bunk beds. This was like a year or two ago.
Like literally. And I want to say it was even after we graduated.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was multiple.
Yeah. This is a common thing.
Yeah. And Knoxville's really bad for human trafficking.
And it's because of where it sits. It's at the crossroads of two of the largest interstates.
You can go any which way. North, south, east, west. You can go all the way to California.
You can go all the way to Maine.
Yeah.
You can go all the way to Miami. You can go all the way to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
I mean, it is truly like terrifying.
Yeah.
I think it's so right that this case may never be solved because of the circumstances surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they would just run the fucking DNA, I don't know why we're like even questioning this.
Right.
Like, though that hair might not be the person who did it, it could get us one answers. Step closer. Yeah. It's a lead.
Right.
From what I read, that this is the primary case being investigated by the Knoxville Cold Case Unit.
Wow.
And I think it was like one of the three cases that is the reason that the Cold Case Unit was founded in Knoxville in 2007.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And so then I was like, well, shit, I should have called the fucking cold case unit. Yeah.
Because I would have loved to like had a conversation about it. I tried to call them. They didn't answer.
Maybe you could revisit.
Well, I left them a voicemail. So
we'll leave them a letter.
If they get back to my voicemail and we like learn something out, we'll do an update.
With our new and improved Creeps and Crime signature.
Yeah. The Chattanooga cold case unit's going to be like, where the fuck did they get that? That is not what they looked like when they were calling us.
Oh, shit. All right.
All right, guys. It's been 2 hours and it is storming violently outside, probably about to knock out the power. So I hope you guys are okay. And because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, we wanted to just like take a very quick second and remind you guys like how important it is when you're listening to cases like this and, you know, you're listening to us. And though we do a better job at not making these cases lighthearted, but giving you guys an in and an out to where you can decompress and just kind of get back to normal, which is something that we've always
tried to do,
even though sometimes it's really hard to bounce back after I cover a really rough case or Morgan covers a really rough case. It's hard for us to do, but it's important for you guys that we do it, and for us, because when you listen to dark things, whether it's paranormal, conspiracy, true crime, it can put you in this mind space of where you're paranoid or where you look for the darker places, mm-hmm. and
feel like your sanity's literally gone.
Right. As two people who literally it's our job to research this stuff and constantly be looking it up, we know it better than anyone. So we wanted to share with you guys like some of the things that we do. And for me, it was, you know, prior to starting this podcast, the reason we started this podcast is that I love listening to podcasts all day long. I was listening to investigative reporting. I was listening to paranormal. I was listening to conspiracy all the time. And it was something that I did throughout my entire day while I was mm-hmm. cleaning, while I was working, no matter what I was doing. I was listening to probably 5 episodes a day, all in the realm of what we do now. When we got into this, you know, full swing going into it, mm-hmm. it got to the point that I was like, I can't listen to this all day long and research it and talk about it because it's just not good for my mental health, Morgan's mental health, our relationships with our partners, so on and so forth. I started making it to where if I was listening to a true crime, paranormal, conspiracy podcast, that I only listen to them when it's not a week that I'm covering a rough case. It's not a week where I'm, you know, kind of burnt out. And I switched my daily podcast from listening to paranormal, true crime and conspiracy podcasts to listening to news podcasts, pop culture, self-help, wellness, something that's educational, something that's light, kind of a back and forth comedy.
Yeah.
And giving myself something that educates me within a different field and also like gives me something to laugh at and not be only consuming dark content. We don't really watch any documentaries or TV shows that come out about anything unless it's for research.
Yeah.
Because once we're off mic, like we've got to separate ourselves from this dark content. And it's something that's really important for you guys to do too. Like listening to music in the car instead of listen to our episodes. But
yeah, we don't want to turn you away.
No, I don't want you to turn you away.
For me, I don't do podcasts. So my go-to is television for sure. But I have noticed since the podcast, like I don't do horror. I can't do true crime documentaries. I go straight to the comedy section. Yep. And I'll tell you what, I'm the first one to put my mental health first. Mm-hmm. I will immediately close that laptop. I will immediately say, Taylor, I can't today.
I will go down with my own mental state.
I am the first one. And honestly, it's as simple for me as just laying there with Ollie mm-hmm. and Aaron and watching television or going outside to the dog park. It always takes me a lot to get outside.
To get out
and
do it.
But once I'm out there, I'm like, fuck, you know, this is so nice. I love doing this. And it's just a nice step away from dark and evil.
Yeah. Just dark evil. Shit. And also like taking some time to move your body and, mm-hmm. you know, listen, you know, for me, I like to listen to
stretch
podcasts when
night.
I work out. Yeah. Take a little ritual where you put your phone away and you're no longer consuming any of that mm-hmm. content before you go to bed. It's not good
the
to
bedtime
be.
The bedtime alert is amazing.
Amazing. And it puts your phone on do not disturb. I get it because I'm someone where when I'm like down bad, like I don't know when to ever stop.
Yeah.
And I'll get so consumed with my stress or a case that I'm covering that it's the only thing that I can exist about, talk about, think about. The only time that I can like actually separate myself from it is when I go and I get in the shower and I turn
you
on
music. You are a water girl.
I'm a water girl. Water sign, Cancer girl right here.
Mm-hmm.
Go talk to Logan Epsom and have conversation.
Salt bath.
Yeah. Just like truly separate myself from the space. You know, go outside and ground yourself, cleanse your home. When you think negative things, they come to you. We cleanse this room all the time. It's just so important.
Yeah. Alternate our meditate podcast with the toast or yeah. Note to self or something.
Note to self. Okay, listen, just go to the Dear Media.
Art of well-being.
I mean, the bitch Bible, whatever you want. Like, go listen to whatever it is that you need to listen to separate yourself.
In between our episodes.
Listen to some, like, you know, news podcasts, like world news, and learn what's going on. Like, I don't know. Maybe don't. Fuck, that might make it worse.
Yeah.
Get your nails done. Get your eyelashes done.
The last thing
you want to
be is the downfall of someone's mental health. So right. Take care of yourself.
And if you need to take some time away from us to do that and you only want to listen to our introductions,
That's fine.
That's fine. And like, that's another side of like Patreon that we have. Like, we do the What's New Wednesdays mm-hmm. on there, which is like a mental break for us.
Yeah.
It's nice because it's, though we are working and recording, we're getting to talk about things that are going on, like actually like have bigger conversation. And our piping hot goss is we don't cover cases in those.
Yeah.
Those are just me and Morgan acting like we're on a phone call for 9.5 hours. So sorry.
Literally 9 hours.
So sorry. But, you know, just things like that. So anyways, just take care of your mental health and remember to prioritize it, especially with the things that we talked about. Not we. She talked about today.
Take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Because we love you.
Take care of you.
And we want you to stay.
We love you. Thank you so much for everyone. Don't forget to go down into our description if you want to order our candles from the collab that we just ran.
CC Merch 10.
CC Merch 10. And then also go check out Theory Home and Lifestyle with Emily. We're going to give you guys the link and the code down in the description. See you next Thursday.
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.